And so good to be with each and every one of you this morning. I don't think I see a little cluster of chairs that is empty, and that's a wonderful sight to see. We do have so many who are here with us this morning as guests, and many of our church family are back with us after some time away. We're so thankful for that. It is such a blessing to see faces that we have missed so much, and to know that we are at least seemingly moving in the right direction. We recognize the struggles that we have faced over the last year, and we are thankful to our God, thankful that He has sustained us throughout, and that He is blessing us to get back where we want to be together with one another, without any sort of worry or concern, simply focused on worshiping our God. That's what we're focusing on doing this morning. Thank you for being here, and may God bless us as we open up His Word together. We're going to begin this morning in the letter of 1 Peter. I want to begin reading with you in 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning in verse 9. 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning in verse 9. I would also be remiss if I didn't mention about John and Laura and little baby Amelia. They seem to be doing well, and they're hoping to go home later on today, which is certainly a blessing. We're thankful for that. Let's continue to pray for them and reach out to them, congratulate them, and see what we can do to help them. I know John says that the grandmas, whatever their grandparent name is going to be, They're ready to go. They're excited for this new grandbaby. They're doing a lot in helping right now, but certainly I'm sure they would appreciate our well wishes, congratulations, and words of love for them. 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning in verse 9, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for His possession, so that you may proclaim the praises of the one who called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Dear friends, I urge you as strangers and exiles to abstain from sinful desires that wage war against the soul. Conduct yourselves honorably among the Gentiles, so that when they slander you as evildoers, they will observe your good works and will glorify God on the day He visits." Peter, as he's writing this letter, writing it to disciples who are part of a new diaspora. We know from centuries back the diaspora, the scattering of the Jews in the Gentile lands. Here we have a second rendition of that, but this time for disciples. As the disciples are scattered throughout the Gentile lands at that time, he seeks to encourage them to find joy, even in the midst of suffering, through the living hope that has been so graciously extended to them through the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. We see that in chapter 1 and verses 1 through 5. "Yet in order for them to live with such a hope, it was necessary for them to prepare their minds for action, to be sober-minded, and to set their hope on the grace that was made available to them through the coming of Jesus," chapter 1 and verse 13. And this preparation would then lead them to live a certain way, to live holy lives that conformed with the holiness that is displayed by their God. And in doing so, they would find themselves fulfilling these words, fulfilling their role as a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for His own possession. And why would they do that? So they could proclaim His praises in this world, as people have been called out of darkness into His marvelous light. And they would go from not being a people to being a people. They would go to being not just a people, but a special people, a unique people, a people who are set apart from those around them by living as strangers and exiles who abstain from the sinful desires that dominate this world. We would do well to recognize, I believe, from this text, that a unique and special people are only such when they are able to follow a unique and special leader. And certainly no leader is more special or can't claim to be any more unique, any more comparable than the God of heaven who made all of this possible. Chapter 1 and verse 3, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ because of His great mercy." This morning, as we continue our focus series for this year of knowing God, I want us to continue on the thought of coming to know God by recognizing His unique nature. His unique nature and how there is no one that can compare to God in any way. And I cannot think of a better text for us to consider along this train of thought than Psalm 89. Psalm 89 is where we're going to be camping at this morning, specifically verses 5 through 18. But this psalm as a whole, this psalm that is attributed to Ethan, the Ezrahite, a Levite musician who's mentioned specifically in 1 Chronicles chapter 15 and verses 7 through 19. As he writes this psalm, we have to recognize that this is kind of a perplexing psalm. It's kind of weird. Let's be real. Let's be honest here. We haven't got to it yet in our daily Bible reading. We'll get to it in, I don't know, 89, May, something. Somebody could correct me on that. But once we get to this psalm and you read it in its entirety, you're going to say, this is kind of strange. And it's strange because it has two very distinctive halves. The first half that we're going to consider, at least a portion of the first half, is very, very praiseworthy. It is focusing very much so on praising God for who He is, what He has done specifically through the line of David, establishing Him as the eternal King upon the throne of Israel. But once you get to verse 37, things change really quickly. And what's strange about Psalm 89 is that Ethan, the Ezrahite, is sort of accusing God of unfaithfulness. But I think it's really inquisitive more than anything else. For the first 36 verses of the psalm, Ethan is praising God, exclaiming the greatness of God, really focusing in on His loving faithfulness, His faithful love to the people of God. And yet at verse 37, he gives the wonder, but Lord, have You forgotten us? Have You changed in some way? We can infer, I believe, from the psalm that Israel at the time of Ethan the Ezrahite is suffering some sort of very low point. And from his perspective, it seems as if God has abandoned him, as if He has forgotten this great promise that He has made to His people, that He has forgotten the faithful love that He has always, always shown to His people, again, specifically through David. And what we're going to focus on this morning out of that is part of the evidence that Ethan gives for God's faithful love. But not just for His faithful love, but for the uniqueness of God and the incomparable nature of God. So again, I cannot think of a better single text this morning to answer this question, who can compare with the Lord? Spoiler alert, the answer is no one. But who can compare to the Lord? No better place to answer that than here in Psalm 89 in verses 5 through 18. Let's read it together. Psalm 89 in verses 5 through 18. Psalm 89 beginning in verse 5. Lord, the heavens praise Your wonders, Your faithfulness also in the assembly of the holy ones. For who in the skies can compare with the Lord? Who among the heavenly beings is like the Lord? God is greatly feared in the council of the holy ones, more awe-inspiring than all who surround Him. Lord, God of armies, who is strong like You, Lord? Your faithfulness surrounds You. You rule the raging sea when its waves surge, and You still them. You crushed Rahab like one who is slain. You scattered Your enemies with Your powerful arm. The heavens are Yours. The earth also is Yours. The world and everything in it, You founded them. North and south, You created them. Tabor to Hermon, shout for joy at Your name. You have a mighty arm. Your hand is powerful, and Your right hand is lifted up. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of Your throne. Faithful love and truth go before You. Happy are the people who know the joyful shout. Lord, they walk in the light from Your face, and they rejoice in Your name all day long, and they are exalted by Your righteousness. For You are their magnificent strength. By Your favor, our horn is exalted. Surely our shield belongs to the Lord, our King, to the Holy One of Israel. Amen. I want us to note, as we begin looking at this specific section of Psalm 89, that we have the first comparison, or really lack of comparison, between God and the spiritual beings of the heavenly unseen realm, that no one compares among this group. as the author is praising the faithful love of God to all the generations. Again, Psalm 89 and verse 1. I will sing about the Lord's faithful love forever. I will proclaim your faithfulness to all generations with my mouth. As he proclaims that, he speaks here in verse 5 through 6 and 7 about how incredibly incomparable and unique God is in every respect, even among those who might be considered somewhat more like him than we ourselves. We can rightly recognize, I believe, this is a setting, speaking of spiritual beings, those who live in the unseen realm, based upon just the location that's mentioned. Notice what is mentioned twice here, and once in verse 5, the other in verse 6, the heavens and the sky. The heavens and the sky. I think this location gives us good insight into exactly who it is that the author is speaking of in this moment. Near ancient Near Eastern peoples, they viewed the sky as a vault resting on foundations. This is how ancient Near Eastern cosmology worked, how they saw the structure of the existence of their reality. And they saw the view they saw the sky as a vault resting on foundations, perhaps mountains, and it had doors and windows that let in the rain, and then God dwelt even above that in the sky, hidden among the clouds and in majesty. And we have to understand that they didn't have what we have today to know really how things are, right? They did not have incredibly powerful telescopes that were able to look into the sky and to view the planets so close up there. They didn't have little robots landing on Mars. Let's be honest here. They didn't have that. So they had to work with what they could just see. So their envisioning of the way things worked out was that there was this firmament above them, and then even above that, in the highest of places, is where God existed. Therefore, if they're speaking about being in the clouds and being in the sky, they're talking about where the spiritual beings, where they dwelt. And if we don't even see the location, if we don't understand the where, then certainly the who that is mentioned here certainly does help us to understand who exactly is being referred to. The assembly of the holy ones, the council of the holy ones, I believe, is very clearly indicating to us spiritual beings. Job chapter 5 and verse 1, and also Job 15 and verse 15. Eliphaz, the Temanites, as he is accusing Job there in chapter 5, he says, Job, well, if God's not going to listen to you, which one of the holy ones are you going to call out to then? If God won't listen, which spiritual being are you going to call out to help you? And then he says in chapter 15 and verse 15 that if even the spiritual beings, the holy ones, are corrupt in some way, then why do you think you could be innocent? So here he uses this language referring to spiritual beings to make his point. Yet the language is the same there in Job as it is to here in Psalm 89. This word heavenly beings that is mentioned in the text is a form of the word Elohim that we talked about in our angels lesson a couple months back. We refer to Elohim, spiritual beings existing in the unseen realm, as being a term of residence. Not exactly describing what they are, but where they are, that Elohim exists in the spiritual unseen realm, apart from ourselves, where we live in a physical seen realm. What Marty talked about, that we can touch, feel, taste, and see, that isn't like God in the spiritual beings. That's who's being referred to here in this section. Well, what's the point? What's the point of bringing up the location of the skies and the who in the spiritual beings? What's to make the comparison that none of them compare? None of them, as glorious as they might be, and as exalted as they might be in living in the spiritual realm and serving God, they don't compare to God. Here's a few notes of evidence from other places, three of them within the Psalms. Notice that he is king and sovereign over all other Elohim. That is Psalm 95 in verse 3. That God is king and sovereign over the other spiritual beings. Psalm 149 and verses 1 through 5 speak of God being the one who created the spiritual beings. He was even before they were. That he alone, we see in Psalm 29 and verse 1, is the only Elohim, again, spiritual being existing in a spiritual unseen realm. He's the only one worthy of worship. And then finally, Nehemiah says in Nehemiah 9 and verse 6, he is declared as you, Lord, are the only God. Now, I know that whenever we read this, we might be thinking, well, yes, he is the only one God because he is the only one who exists. But we have to recognize, I think, by this point, that that's just not the reality. There are other spiritual beings that exist, whether they be angels, whether they be seraphim, or there be cherubim. There are other spiritual beings that exist in the spiritual unseen realm. Yet he is the only true God. And he is such because he reigns sovereign over them. And he is able to reign sovereign over them because he actually created them. And he, because of these incredible attributes, he's the only one worthy to be worshipped. And just think throughout the Bible, different stories where angels, where people try to worship angels. And how they would even say, listen, that's not what I don't accept that. Or where people sought to worship other people as if they were something special. They were some sort of incredible being. And think about Paul and Barnabas saying, no, we don't take that. We're not worthy of worship. Only God alone is worthy of worship. In this text, we find to begin with that God is unique and incomparable even to the other spiritual beings who live in the heavenly unseen realm. But as we continue through the text, we also see that he is incomparable and he is unique in every way because of the strength he possesses to control and to create. To control and to create. We see that verses 8 through 13. Ethan, the author of this psalm, he says, Lord God of armies. And he asks the question, who is strong like you? Now, the title, the way that Ethan addresses the Lord here, really answers the question already. He is the commander of the host of heaven. He is the commander of all the heavenly hosts, all the angels, all the seraphim, all the cherubim, all the spiritual beings. As we just noted in our last point, he commands them all. He has all power. Remember, anytime I see this term used for God, I always think of Jesus almost. I almost always think of Jesus. And as he's on trial, he is saying, listen, if I wanted to call 10,000 legions of angels, I could do so. Why? Well, because he commands the hosts of heaven. We're going to get more to Jesus here in just a few moments. Yet this descriptor is further built upon as the author talks about God's power to control all things and even bring all things into existence. He speaks here in this text of the Lord being able to rule the raging sea and to still the surging waves. For ancient peoples, the sea. Well, the sea was really the last great frontier. For us, we often think of space as being the last great frontier. That's the last thing that we really have to conquer and navigate as a people in the 21st century. Well, for them, it was the sea. It was the sea because for them, the sea was uncontrollable. It was untamable. It was a really dicey situation anytime you got out upon the large waters. And therefore, for it to be said of God that he rules the raging sea, that he is able to calm the waves, that was a very strong statement of power and strength. That he could control even this. And then he builds upon that even more by saying that he even controlled and crushed Rahab like one who was slain. Rahab was a mythical ancient beast who represented, it was a sea beast who represented chaos and havoc. It just wreaked turmoil upon those who would come across it. Therefore, here is the author saying that God is even able to crush a beast such as this and to control such a one. And maybe the meaning and the understanding of this is what's seen in that second line of verse 10, that you scattered your enemies with a powerful arm. These type of creatures, Rahab and others, they could also be used to be as a moniker for enemies of certain people, for those who wanted to wreak chaos and wreak havoc upon peoples. Therefore, for God to be able to crush Rahab and to scatter his enemies could stand as an understanding of here is God who is in control of all things. The sea cannot overcome him. Rahab cannot overcome him. Even the most powerful of enemies, he has complete and total control over. Again, he is sovereign not just over the spiritual beings, but also over the creation. Well, why? Well, he's sovereign over the creation because it's his creation. He is the one who founded the heavens, the earth, the world and everything in it. What we have here in these verses, in verse 12, in verse 11 and 12, is all-encompassing language. Everything that is mentioned here, the heavens, the earth, even going to the sea, that was everything they knew that was in existence. And yet God has brought all that under subjection, and he's done so because he founded them from the highest point in the north to the farthest point in the south, from the great mountain of Tabor over here to the great mountain of Hermon over here. Everything Ethan the Ezrahite says is under God's control. And for this one being to be in such great control, for him to have everything within his grasp, and for not a single thing to happen without his allowing it to happen, we see the picture being painted here. That God is incomparable. And he is unique. Everything that exists in the natural seen world, and everything that exists in the spiritual unseen world, everything he controls. Everything he rules over. Everything he even brought into existence. What a unique and incredible God it is that we serve and that Ethan speaks of here within this text. And yet, we have one more section we need to consider where Ethan goes on to say that no one compares with his attributes. Not just what he has done and what he is able to do, but actually how he goes about it. No one can compare. And what a blessing is that no one can compare, because his people get to be blessed in a way beyond comparison as well. There are four qualities that are stated as being the foundation of God's throne. They are righteousness, they are justice, they are faithful love, and they are truth. They are the legs on which the throne of God stands on. They are the attributes by which he rules sovereignly over this world. And as a result, let's notice what happens. As a result, number one, those who know the joyful shout, those who worship him, those who serve him are happy. Number two, they walk in the light of his face. Number three, they rejoice in his name all day long. And number four, they are exalted by his righteousness. And certainly these attributes, being the defining features of God, the defining attributes of God, they do make him unique and they do make him special, because we know all too well, unfortunately, that these are not always the attributes of those who rule us. And they are not always the attributes of those who have ruled throughout the history of mankind. Unfortunately, wickedness, injustice, and falsehoods have always been perpetrated by earthly rulers. Yet God is said here in this text, he is shown to be incomparable, and he is shown to be unique, and that he rules in a different way, in a perfect way, in a way that brings great blessings to his people. And that's the reality of this. It isn't just an academic thing that we understand that he rules through righteousness, and that he rules through justice, faithful love, and truth. But it's very pragmatic as well, because it does bless his people. As we already mentioned, they're able to do what they do in shouting joyfully, being happy, walking in the light of his face, rejoicing in his name. They are exalted, but even beyond that, they are strengthened. And they are empowered as his people. Verse 17, for you are their magnificent strength, and by your favor our horn is exalted. This is just language of strengthening and of empowerment. That they are to be this type of people because of the God they serve. And this is also true in the context of the psalm based upon the kings who the Lord appoints to lead his people. Remember, much of the focus here in Psalm 89 is on the Davidic kingship and on David's lineage continuing to rule the throne and to prosper on that throne. And Ethan's sitting here thinking, you know, things aren't looking too great, Lord. That's verse 37. But before he gets there, he recognizes verse 18. He recognizes verse 18 is the standard. That this is what is to be expected, that our shield or our king belongs to the Lord, our king to the Holy One of Israel. And if our shield, our king, and we can, and I believe the understanding of the king being the word shield here can go back to chapter or to Psalm 84 and verse 9. Psalm 84 verse 9, I believe, makes a connection there between the shield being the king. But he's given his understanding here that if the king belongs to God, then the expectation is for the king to be strengthened, the king to be empowered, and for the king even himself to try to emulate God in ruling in righteousness, in faithful love, in justice, and in truth. Yeah, that's not possible, except that God strengthens him to do so. So in these ways, we see in this text that he is incomparable, completely unique. There is no one in the spiritual unseen realm who compares. There is nothing in the material seen world that compares. And there's no other being that has the attributes that God displays perfectly. So what do we learn then from this text? What do we come to know about God? And it is basically the summation of what I just said, that no being, whether spiritual or physical, whether seen or unseen, can compare with him in any way. That is redundant. I recognize that, but it's just the reality of what we're seeing this morning from this text, that nothing compares in any way. Now, you might recognize that the incomparable nature of God, we actually began talking about that in our last study last month as we were in Acts 17, and talked about how God is totally necessary. How he is wholly independent of anything else, he simply is. He just is. And nothing else can say that. Nothing else can say that it has no beginning and no end. It just simply is. Again, that is true of all the spiritual beings. That is true of everything in the physical world. Nothing else can make this claim. And in fact, not only can everything else not make this claim, but everything else is actually dependent on him. For within him we live and move and what? And have our very being. That is not only true of us as humans as we speak that, but that is true of the entire existence. Again, whether spiritual or physical, whether seen or unseen, everything depends on God allowing it to be. Nothing exists apart from him. He alone is the totally independent God. He is without comparison. He is wholly unique. Yet I want to build upon that point by recognizing this. I mentioned Jesus earlier, and I mentioned him because he can claim the same things. Jesus can claim these same things from the New Testament, from what is taught within it. And this is an important point to make, I believe, because some would try to say that that's not true. That Jesus is not totally independent, but that he was even created, that he was birthed in a sense. And they want to take the beautiful truth of John 3:16, and they want to try to make that point. Turn over to John 3:16 real fast. I want to notice the word that they're going to key in on, especially from older translations, to try to make this a reality. John 3 and verse 16. Again, forgive the modern language of the Christian Standard Bible, but it says, "For God loved the world in this way," or as we all know, "For God so loved the world, that he gave his one and only Son, so that everyone who believes in him will not perish but have eternal life." Remember the older translations, King James, New King James, New American Standard, 95, they would say that God gave his only begotten Son. Begotten Son, that is the Greek term, monogenes. Used to, Greek scholars, of course I'm not one, but I can read about this, they used to think that a portion of that word was a verb. That it was a verb, that it was birthed. That it was the only birthed son. And people would kind of pounce upon that and try to use that to say that Jesus actually had a beginning. That whenever he was given into the world, it was a literal birth that he gave into existence. But as people have discovered more and as they've learned more about ancient languages And as they found more ancient documents that allow them to grow in their understanding of those ancient languages and their meanings, they actually realized that that's a noun. And that it isn't to say that he was the only birthed son of God, but that he was the one of a kind, unique son of God. I believe every person here would say that. We would all agree with that. Yes, that's exactly the case. We've always understood that, but we have to recognize that other people have not. They want to use this to say that he has a beginning. But what we understand from this text is that it's not that he has a beginning, but he is one of a kind. He is unique. Let's give some further evidence for that. Hebrews 11 and verse 17. It is said of Abraham, of Isaac, that he is the only begotten son of Abraham. If we're going to apply what people want to claim about Jesus being the only birthed son of God, then wouldn't we claim that Isaac is the only birthed son of Abraham? Did Abraham only have one son? No. He only had one son. He had many. We know, at least Isaac, Ishmael, right? But what was special about Isaac? He was the promised son. He was the one-of-a-kind, unique son of Abraham. Therefore, what we recognize from this is that Jesus stands as incomparable himself. He himself stands as the incomparable, unique Son of God who is able to claim superiority over the heavenly beings himself. Remember, the angels came to serve him during his ministry in times of need. He is also seen as having complete control over even the waters. Remember, we've seen that in our studies in Mark, that he commanded the waves to stand still, and they did. And what did they say? Who can do this? The apostles proclaimed. Who can do this? Taking us back to this text and others. He also is said in John 1 and verse 1 through 5 that he was a part of the creation process. And finally, he is the one who is able to be seen as defined by righteousness, justice, faithful love, and truth throughout his ministry and in all he did. These are all true about Jesus. And it is only further claim, only further evidence to really show us beyond a shadow of a doubt that he is God. Now, of course, somebody might say, well, how does that work? How can there be God and Jesus? Well, come back later on this year and we'll talk about the triune God. We'll try to dig through that a little bit more. This is simply to show, though, the truth of what I believe scriptures will show, that not only is God unique and incomparable, but the same is true for Jesus the Son. But here's the second thing I want us to recognize about God from this text. It is the fact that his unique nature allows him to uniquely bless those who serve him. That because of his unique nature, those who serve him are able to live unique lives. Just as those of his holy ones feared and revered him, those of us who do the same are able to be benefited by the truth of his uniqueness in incredible ways. Again, go back to where we began in 1 Peter chapter 2. Back in 1 Peter chapter 2, as we read through that, you might have been thinking, man, this sounds familiar. It sounds really familiar for Peter to be writing about a people who are a chosen people, who are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession. That sounds really familiar. And if it sounds familiar with you, then you need to recognize that it should sound familiar, because these exact same things are true about the nation of Israel. That they too were a chosen race, Deuteronomy 7 and verse number 6. That they too are a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, Exodus 19 verses 5 and 6. All of these were true about Israel, and they are true about the people of God today. Therefore, we do see ourselves, as I mentioned, as a unique people. Yet, we have to recognize what separates us from the rest. What is it that makes us unique? What is it that makes us comparable from the rest of the people in the world? Number one, because of our status as a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, we are able to proclaim the praises of God in a dark world. We stand out from the dark world. We stand out as unique from the dark world because we proclaim God and not ourselves. We proclaim the will of God and not our own will. And in doing so, we live the type of lives that are described in this text as strangers and exiles who are abstaining from the sinful desires that war against the soul. We abstain from those things. We are different. We are unique. We are incomparable to the world because we don't follow in the same footsteps of evil and wickedness as the world does. We don't do that. Well, why? Because we've come out of that. We had not been a people who received mercy. Now we have received mercy. And because we have received mercy, we are expected to be that unique people, that special people, that incomparable people. We are to be different. And how are we blessed in that? Well, we are blessed in that in the fact that we get to live with hope. That as the rest of the world, and we've seen this especially in the past year, haven't we? As the rest of this world lives without hope, being totally captivated by fear and by anxiety and by worry, thinking that if I get this virus and I die, that's it for me. We don't live like that. We have hope. No, we're not going to go around licking doorknobs. We're not going to be foolish. But we're also not going to live scared, are we? We're not going to live scared because we have a hope. We are different. We are unique. We are special from the rest of the world. And we better live like it because we've received mercy. And that mercy comes with expectation that we live differently and that we live uniquely. That we take that mercy and we take that grace and we allow it to transform us. To make us that different and unique people, that we allow the Spirit to strengthen us to live the way that we are expected to live. If we are going to serve a unique and incomparable God, brothers and sisters, then we ourselves better be a unique and incomparable people. That is the truth that we cannot ignore. And that leads us to our main point for this morning. What I really want us to take away from this, as we consider God first, as we consider God first as being unique in His nature and being incomparable in every way, we need to recognize that that allows us to live as incomparable and unique people. That allows us to do so, no longer under the burden and guilt of sin, no longer under the dominion of sin, but we live differently. And living differently, we're able to hope differently. We have hope for eternity and life forever. You know those terms? Unique, incomparable, one of a kind. They are so often used as descriptors to show just how incredible something is here in this world. Look at this one of a kind, unique, incomparable diamond, for example. And because of these things, I'm going to charge you a gazillion dollars for it. And yet those terms, they just really lose their luster. When we think about the truly incomparable and unique nature of God. That there's nothing that compares to Him in any way at all. Yet we can't just recognize this being true, can we? We have to allow it to impact us and to change us so that we fear and revere Him like nothing else. Yet we also should be extremely thankful for His incomparable and for His unique nature, that we are able to have joy in that. Because He is incomparable, because He is unique, so are we. And what a blessing that is. As we consider this morning the unique nature of God, don't just see this as an academic exercise. It's not just that we recognize what He is incomparable and unique. But He allows us to live in the same way as an incomparable and unique people who have real and true hope even in this hopeless world.